to the Space Coast April 16th, 2011 meeting. It's so nice to see so many happy faces jammed in this room. You all surprised me. For the ones that did not receive a package, because we did run out at 150, in that package was an evaluation form. This form, if you did not receive one, let me know. I'm having 50 more printed right now, so you can have them because they must be filled out and returned to us after the meeting. If you do not return them, you will not get a certificate. Now, could you all please rise for the Pledge of Allegiance? Pledge of Allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you. We have a bunch of new business members that came in because with the trade show, and they were part of the trade show. We had Jan Clean, Gerald Environmental Services, InSphere Insurance Solutions, Cape Coast Industries, Next Generation Heat and Air, Communications Consulting Services, Associated Financial Services, Florida Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home, Onboard Management Incorporated, Beach Pool Services, Mary Kay Cosmetics, Universal Trust Association Management, Patty General Insurance Agency, Bartow's Lawn Care Service, and Green Arc, Inc. The next President's Forum for Space Coast will be on May 14th, and I would like for everybody to thank Leyland Management for all the wonderful food that you guys are eating this morning. Thank you, Leyland. Today's meeting, as you're all aware, is for the certification of board members. And if you're not a board member and you don't want to get certified, that's okay, because you still definitely will learn something. All right? Now, what we need is for each manager and or board member must turn in a signed and printed evaluation form in order to receive your certificate and your credits. The CAM must provide the CAM license number, which I'm sure you're all familiar. And at the end of the class, we will be collecting all of the signed and printed evaluation forms. You come up here, you drop them off at the table. We'll also give the ones who do not have them as of yet. You can get a copy of 61B. And you'll also get a copy of 718 and a copy of the division's self-teaching manual for budgets and reserves. Our speaker and our teacher for the day is Lance Klaus from Becker and Polyakov, and he will be running through this entire procedure. He's done this many times, so I'm not going to step on his toes. All right, I would like to introduce Mr. Lance Klaus from Becker and Polyakov.
Today's course is called Everything You Wanted to Know About Being a Board Member But Were Afraid to Ask. And I want to encourage you to ask questions. It's going to be a little harder in a group this size, but the format that we've tried to take on with these board certifications is to make it much more interactive. We like to have questions and answers and try to have it as a dialogue as much as possible, because I think that tends to make it more interesting for the participants. We'll see how well that goes with a group this large, but nonetheless, bear with us for that. For you folks that have the folders, the 150 chosen few, if you'll look in your folders, there should be an outline that's about a, I think it's four-page outline that has the title of the course at the top. And as you pull those out, you'll see that it's basically just a pretty rough outline broken into about eight different Roman numeral topics. And the reason why I point that out is what I'd like to do initially, because the materials that we have to cover today, we could basically be here for probably 3 days and not completely exhaust all of the materials to be addressed. So what we try to do to have the conversation be, you know, at least as meaningful as possible is to try to go over and focus more on some specific topic areas that you folks would like to discuss in more depth. And so what I'm going to do here now is we're going to go through the outline, which I'll just read through, so that way also I can say that I did in fact go through all of the outline, so no one can complain about that. But what I would like for you to think about as we kind of go through it here initially is think about which of these Roman numeral topics that you would, four Roman numeral topics that you'd like to discuss primarily. And then once we've kind of gone through it, I'm going to essentially take a show of hands to get a sense of which topics those may be, and we'll try to focus our best on those. Now, bear in mind, there will be some overlap between some of the other categories, so don't think they're going to be mutually exclusive in any way. And some topics will naturally lead into another question that may deal in a related but different topic area. And that's okay, because I think it shows how everything sort of ties together. Also, I just want to note that on your tables in the middle, there are note cards, little 3x5 cards. And for folks who would like to ask questions but don't want to raise their hand and ask it in front of a large group, you can write your question on the card. And we'll probably take a break about an hour and a half through. If you'd like, you can put the cards up here. Is that probably the best way to work it, Roger? So we'll do that. And then for the other folks that are the brave souls who aren't afraid to ask the questions, then you, of course, can just raise your hand. The only thing I ask is try to ask questions that are, of course, in the topic area that I'm discussing at the moment. And also try to limit the fact patterns to a reasonable amount. We want to try to have it be much more of a general applicability, so that way everybody can benefit from the questions and hopefully the answers. And without further ado, let's get started. The first Roman numeral you'll see in your outline, and just briefly, I apologize to the folks who came and did not get an outline of sorts. There were copies made?
No, share with your neighbor.
Oh yeah, please if you can share with your neighbor or look off of it. It's not real extensive anyway, so it's just mainly a guide. But in any event, sorry there weren't enough. We brought 150, and I think we're probably pushing over 200 today. And I think she had some extras there as well, if anybody would like to have some. Oh, that's the evaluation form. The cameraman is leading me astray. Look at that. All right. I'll let some folks who need some evaluation forms grab those real quick. And while they're grabbing those extra evaluation forms, I know Roger had pointed it out, but I just wanted to also note that for folks, they have some great materials over here. Primarily, everything that you'll have to know, at least statutorily, is in this, the Condominium Act, Chapter 718, which they have a handout here. It's also available online, but you might as well have a hard copy if they have it available for you. They also have a copy of the Florida Administrative Code. Now, I haven't looked at the specific printout, but I assume it's just all of the relevant code sections to deal with condominiums. So this is an excellent source as well. I'm going to talk about it later on, but I'll just note it now. There's also a handout over here put out by the division, the Department of Business Professional Regulation, concerning budgets and reserve schedules. And I'll touch on that a little bit more later, but that's an excellent resource as well. This CD-ROM, I haven't had the pleasure of actually seeing myself, but I understand that it is put out by the division as well, and it also has some beneficial educational references and materials on it as well. And they'll also be available at the break for any other folks who would like to get that. We won't refer so much specifically to anything that's directly, you won't have to turn to page 23 or anything like that in the statutes. But nonetheless, it'll be good to have. All right, does everybody have an evaluation now that didn't otherwise have one when they came in? Anybody not have an evaluation? Okay, all right, I think we're good. Yeah. Yeah, if everybody could go ahead and get seated, we can pick up the rest of the materials during the break. And we'll probably take a break about 10:30 for about 5 to 10 minutes, and then we'll finish up after that. All right. Well, let's get started here with the outline here, so everybody is familiar with what we're addressing. Roman numeral 1 deals with condominium operations. We'll deal with association responsibilities, fiduciary relationships of the board members, association powers and duties. Also, in this section, talk briefly about insurance. Also, annual meetings of the unit owners. I'm sure most of you are familiar with those. Maintenance of the common elements, director voting at board meetings, commingling of association funds, responding to unit owner inquiries, holding and noticing meetings, also soliciting and accepting kickbacks. Which, as you can guess, is a no-no. But Roman numeral 2, the next topic that we have is records maintenance, including owner access to records. We'll include the official records that are required to be maintained. Also talk about unit owner inspection rights. Also, some of the consequences concerning a denial of access to those records. Also, specifying what records are not available for inspection by owners that may otherwise still be official records. Talk about rules and regulations regarding records inspection, and also record maintenance and retention policies. Then also, Roman numeral 3 here, we'll discuss, discuss dispute resolution, whether that's with the division. When we say division, that's the division of Florida condominiums, timeshares, and mobile homes. Mention mediation briefly. Also talk about the mandatory non-binding arbitration process. Suspension of use rights. Enforceability of rules and regulations. And then in Roman numeral 4, if the group wants to discuss this, we'll discuss condominium budgets and reserves, including the budget meeting notices, operating budget requirements, the 115% rule, also condominium reserves, which will discuss requirements regarding reserves, a reserve calculation, briefly talk about the straight line methods or pooled reserves, interest generated from reserves, also commingling of those accounts. And we'll talk about other reserves and waiving reserves or providing reserves less than full funding. Also discuss limit common elements in the context of budgeting. And also address unrestricted expense categories. Now 5, and of all the ones that I've done with this one, we've had very few folks who wanted to talk about the election process, because most of you folks, if you're coming to meetings like this, you probably know what the election process entails. But nonetheless, we can talk about this in full depth if you'd like. But we'll talk about electing the board, terms of office, candidate eligibility, the notice procedures, the first notice, second notice, notices of intent by the candidates, campaigning, the ballot, conducting your election and tabulating the results, including the envelope requirements, tiebreakers, voting machines, assistance voting, alternate election procedures, which doesn't come into play very often, and board member certification, which, again, we won't have to talk about that very long, because if you're here, you know about board certification. Roman numeral 6 addresses condominium financial reporting. We'll discuss reports of cash receipts, and disbursements, financial statements and what the different levels of reporting are, financial statement components, multi-condominium association disclosures if it comes up, GAAP and GAAS. Now, does anybody know what GAAP stands for? Generally Accepted Accounting Procedures. What about GAAS? This one has a tendency to stump people.
Adjusted Accounting Standards.
Very close. My understanding is, and I spoke with a CPA about this, it's Generally Accepted Auditing Standards. But you got the idea. You got the idea. And probably by and large, that's the most I will discuss about those two topics for the most part, because usually I'll refer that to my CPA colleagues to address those types of things. But nonetheless, we'll touch upon it to the extent that it's legally relevant. And also talk about providing for a lower level of year-end financial reporting. Next topic is usually a pretty hot topic for folks to discuss, and that's Roman numeral 7, dealing with insurance. We'll talk about insurance, and usually when people think of insurance, they usually think, okay, well, we're going to talk about, you know, casualty insurance and hurricanes and all of that, and we will. But there's also other insurance considerations to think about as a board. So we'll address those as well. Talk about what's required to be insured, types of insurance, determining insurance deductibles, and in a casualty context, what is not covered by the association's policy, and conversely, what is covered by the unit owner policy. Reconstruction after a property loss, dealing with multi-condominiums, unit owner responsibilities for repairs or replacement costs, deductible opt-out, and also fidelity bonds for, and also directors and officers insurance there. And then the last category here we have for Roman numeral 8 is a pretty broad topic, but it's basically condominium ownership, restrictions and responsibilities of unit owners, and financial responsibilities of unit owners. So if you would, take a look at that for just about 30 seconds or so, if you would, and decide which of the four categories that you'd like to focus on, and then I'll give a second. I'll take a show of the hands, and we'll go with that. Okay, 10 second warning. Okay, is everybody ready? All right. Who would like to discuss Roman numeral 1, condominium operations? Okay, pretty good group. I think we'll discuss that. All right, great. What about records maintenance? Okay, not as popular. We'll put that down here. All right, dispute resolution. Okay, I think there may have been more for the other one. How about condominium budgets and reserves? All right, quite a few. Elections? All right. That's been the trend. For the two people that raise your hands, catch me at the break and I'll be happy to answer all your election questions. What about Roman numeral 6 concerning financial reporting? All right, a little less. What about insurance? Okay, we'll definitely talk about insurance. and condominium ownership. Okay. All right. Well, the people have spoken, and I think what we'll talk about first, or we'll deal with condominium operations, which is a pretty broad category. I mean, I could probably talk for 2 hours and have, unfortunately, on condominium operations alone. But the thing about condominium operations is it really does encompass everything you do because you are operating a condominium. So let's get started here. Association responsibilities. Does anybody have any examples of what association may be responsible for? Common elements? That's right. Operating and maintaining the common elements, I'd say, is a primary responsibility of a condominium association. And what that entails, of course, is making sure that you maintain the common elements and other portions of the condominium property that the association is responsible for maintaining, not only on a regular basis, but also planning for any long-term deferred maintenance or capital improvement projects that may be necessary to maintain that property. And we'll definitely get into that a lot more, especially when we talk about budgeting and reserves and all of that. But that's the primary responsibility. And from fiduciary relationship, board members in the statute, and it even cites a section here, 718.111.1A, states that the directors have a fiduciary relationship to the unit owners. It doesn't say to the association. It doesn't say to the corporation. It says to the unit owners. So it's always important to bear in mind that when you're taking action as a board and as a board member, that you need to do it from the standpoint of the best interest of all of the unit owners and not, of course, from personal interest or personal agendas, which can come into play. But it truly is for the good of all the unit owners. Now, I've seen in a lot of situations where sometimes to honor your fiduciary responsibilities, a board will have to do things that the unit owners don't like. Can anybody think of any instances where that might come into play? Special assessments? Yeah. Yes, a lot of times special assessments, but usually the special assessment is a result of something else that the board has to do. A perfect example that I've used on many occasions for any folks that live in a high-rise condominium on the water. Have you ever heard of concrete restoration? That one has a tendency to sneak up on people and communities. And as if you've gone through that process, you realize how intensive it is and how expensive it is. And a lot of times, even if you have a community that fully funds its reserves and has thought about the fact that they may have to do a concrete restoration project sometime in the future. The reserves are always an educated guess of what the cost might actually be at the time that you have to go through the process. And sometimes there is, in fact, a shortfall, and which will, often necessitate the need for a special assessment, or sometimes you can get a loan if you have that ability at the time. It's not unusual for a board to have to make a decision for particularly for a major project like concrete restoration, or I represent a community that had to replace every single sewer pipe in their entire building. Imagine how intrusive that was on the unit owners and on the units. Not to mention there wasn't enough money in the reserves. And of course, it was very very unpopular, and there were a lot of special assessments, actually two that had to be levied in that instance. But the reason I stress that is that's a situation where the unit owners weren't happy at all about the fact that the association was actually meeting its obligations to maintain, repair, and replace the common elements and maintain the condominium property. And in fact, I've seen situations where a board has levied a special assessment. And, the very next week, they're served with a recall petition. Sometimes those recall petitions are successful. Sometimes they are not. But I always strongly urge those boards that, you know, if they're being threatened with those types of things, you have to weigh what your fiduciary obligations are against the fear of being unpopular. And there are instances where I've seen boards be completely ousted because they were doing the right thing. Now, in those situations, those board members were acting in good faith, and in most instances, they relied on an engineer or someone else to tell them that that there was these things had to be done. And so I always use that as an example too to say, okay, well, what about the new board that comes in after the folks that just got recalled? And then once they look at all of the evidence and speak with the engineer and talk about the project, they have a fiduciary obligation to do that as well. Now, they may try to say, okay, well, let's see if we can stretch it out, or let's see if we can get a loan, let's see if we can avoid the special assessment if at all possible. Okay, that's fine. But it doesn't mean that they can just get into office, put on the brakes, and completely stop a maintenance project that is absolutely necessary. Because what happens? What happens if you have a concrete restoration project that really needs to be done, and you know it gets to the point where it's so far gone you've got big chunks of concrete falling off into the sea?
Lawsuits.
And if they're lawsuits, do you think that just because you're a board member on a not-for-profit corporation that you'll be insulated from any personal liability in that instance? No. In fact, there's cases that state that if board members can be personally liable if they act in bad faith. Now, it's probably not a pretty hard stretch when you have a board that has all the facts, has all the evidence, sees that, in a lot of instances it's even visually observable from a layperson that the concrete is cracking and there's chunks of it falling off. If somebody, a year later gets hit on the head with a big, chunk of concrete, God forbid, and that board had not taken any steps to try to address that, there could be some culpability there. Now, how do you avoid a claim that somebody that you had acted in bad faith? Well, you rely on your professionals. You rely on the engineers who advise you. You rely on your association counsel who tells you what the law is or gives you your options. And you rely on your CPA for tax filings and for financial report preparations. And in many instances, that will give you at least a good faith defense to say that you relied upon those professionals' advice in order to make the decisions you had. Now, don't get me wrong. Ordinary negligence is you'll typically be protected. The association has a statutory and often in your documents a documentary obligation to indemnify and hold board members harmless who may or commit some or at least alleged to have committed some type of negligent act in their capacity as a board member. But that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about those instances where the board knew or as individuals knew or should have known that those projects needed to be done, yet they didn't do it, and those folks were injured. Can anyone think of any other examples in which a board member might be personally liable for actions that they take as a board member? Yes, ma'am.
Can I ask if that applies to things that should be done to maintain the condo's market value compared to other like condos?
The question is, does the fiduciary obligation also apply to maintaining the community just for resale value?
Well,
is that essentially
a...
Camera guy says I have to reiterate these questions, so I'm trying to think how to do that. Basically, the question is, does the board have that fiduciary duty to maintain the community in the same manner as like condominiums for essentially, it sounds like aesthetic purposes to some extent, for market value. And I would say that a board typically has a fair amount of discretion as far as when they do certain maintenance projects, unless there is a immediate need or there's an emergency to try to address something. Someone could, of course, make the argument that, the community's not being maintained properly and it's affecting the market value. And that does happen in some instances. But having red flowers as opposed to blue flowers, won't necessarily make the unit worth any less or any more in most instances. So there can be, some leeway as far as that's concerned. It's always, a matter of degree. If the washing machines are always broken, if the paint is cracking and peeling off the wall in huge sheets, if the driveway is cracked and there's huge ruts, there's several reasons why you'd want to address that. Liability reasons, of course, but of course for aesthetic reasons as well. Yes, ma'am.
Well, in your former question about liability for the board, how about when the board signs a contract saying that the elevator service is completely held safe from any harm, no matter if they did the parts wrong or not? In other words, the contract states that they're just completely not liable for anything that happens, any accidents that happen, anybody who becomes injured on or near the property of the elevator, even if it was their fault. Isn't that really the board's fault?
The question was, does the board have any culpability if they essentially sign a contract that essentially indemnifies the other party for any acts, even in their own wrongdoing? Mm-hmm. Is that a fair reiteration? And I think really that addresses really even a broader issue, if I may expand upon it a little bit. It's happened more than once that we've gotten a signed contract from association that's let's say it's even a 7-year contract, and the board president sends it to us in a fax and says, "Hey, we just signed this contract. Take a look at it and let me know what you think." And that, I think, clearly drives home the point that, just as I said before, to act in good faith, you rely on your professionals. In that instance, I would suggest you have your association counsel look at the contract before you sign it and turn it over to the other side. And those types of indemnifications that you had talked about were basically, they could frankly, probably murder somebody and on purpose, and you'd still have to indemnify those. Well, most of the time, we'll tweak those provisions to make them a little bit more even-handed. But it's a little bit difficult to go back and negotiate that after the fact. The old adage, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, that's very true when you deal with these types of things. I like to practice preventative law as opposed to curative law. Preventative law being we fix this, we address these issues in the contract before they're signed, because then if the parties don't agree, don't have a meeting of the minds, you look for the next vendor. You go on to the next thing, and you go to the contractor that will be fair and reasonable with the association to address.
So is the board liable if they've done that?
Well, then it goes back if potentially if there is an instance where somebody is injured and that comes up, then particularly I would say as far as any liability it was usually come in as far as personal liability would come in a situation where maybe the association's insurance company didn't otherwise cover whatever so there would be an assessment against the owners, and maybe the owners want to sue the individual for that shortfall because it was their fault. Is it possible? Sure. The question will be, did they act in good faith, I think, in those instances. And also, this leads to a couple of other points that I wanted to raise for, board liability, individual board liability. In addition to bad faith, that comes up to the other issue of gross negligence. Now, if you're, and I want to make a distinction between ordinary negligence and gross negligence. The distinction is, the example that I've used is that, just to visualize it, Let's say that I'm driving my car down the highway, and I'm going, the speed limit's 70 miles an hour. I'm going 70 miles an hour. And I look in my rearview mirror, and I don't see anything, but I don't turn and look in my blind spot. And then I come into the lane. There was somebody in my blind spot, and I wind up sideswiping them. I was negligent. Would you say I was negligent? I probably wasn't grossly negligent. Gross negligence would be I'm driving down the road at 100 miles an hour with a blindfold on after having drank a bottle of Jack Daniels and sitting in the back seat with my hand over the seat holding on to the steering wheel, and an accident happens. Now, that's an obviously extreme example of that, but I think you see the distinction between ordinary negligence and gross negligence. Gross negligence is such a matter of degree that an ordinary person knew or should have known that it could cause injury or harm, and it did, in fact, result in that, almost to the point of it was intentional. Like you may have not necessarily looked at somebody and jerked over and hit them. That would be intentional. But you knew they could have been there. You knew or should have known. Had you even bothered to look? And so there are instances where gross negligence, from a board member's standpoint, you could be personally liable. Now, to equate that directly to association, what would be an example of something you can think of that would be just so egregious, so outrageous that a board would do that might amount to gross negligence?
Yes.
That's an excellent example. What this gentleman said was don't carry, and I'm going to elaborate, casualty insurance or property insurance. The statute mandates it. You're required to have it. If you don't carry it, you could be grossly negligent in that instance. So bear that in mind. Can anyone think of any other examples in which a board member could, in fact, be personally liable? Anyone? How about if they're stealing money out of the reserve account and buying a boat? Now, I don't want to be accused of giving anybody any ideas. That is. I'm talking about other. That's not gross negligence. I'm onto another aspect that could create board liability. Of course, if an individual steals money from the association and uses it for their own purposes, borrowing is stealing. just to clarify, and that's a good point. Don't borrow money from the association. The association is not a lending institution. If anyone finds that you've borrowed money for your own personal purposes, don't be surprised if you do, in fact, have the police called on you and have an investigation. So it's very serious and very important. Yes, ma'am?
What if you vote against it? You're the only board member that votes against it and you still get outvoted. Are you still liable if you think it's wrong?
Give me more of a specific example, if you may.
For something that's grossly, negligent,
mm-hmm.
then the board votes.
The board voted
and
not
you say,
happy.
No, I don't like this idea.
The insurance exemption.
Mm-hmm. If you vote against it, that of course gives you, the question for the camera was that what if you, as a board member, vote against an action that the board is taking that you know is either grossly negligent or perhaps criminal or in bad faith? I'd say as far as insulating yourself, of course, the first step is to, vote no. You can show that you've voted no. But if it's so egregious, particularly if it's a criminal action, if you don't tell someone, if you don't, either report it to the owners or, really and truly a criminal situation, if the board is ignoring you, you may have to go to the authorities, go to the state's attorney's office. If you take those steps, then it will be very difficult for someone to say that you acted in bad faith. Now, it's always going to be with any of these situations, it's always going to be a matter of degree, and you want to be careful not to cast any aspersions or potentially defamatory statements against anybody unless you know all of the facts. But if you're in a situation where you clearly know that what the board is attempting to do is illegal or criminal, you know, from that standpoint, then you certainly need to speak up early and often. Yeah. Yes, ma'am. The question was, what about those situations where the board allows a non-insured vendor, like a contractor, to work on the premises? And it may depend on whether it's a matter of, you know, a unit owner hiring the non-insured vendor versus whether the association is hiring the non-insured vendor to work on, you know, certain portions of the property. It's always a good business practice, of course, to have... from the association standpoint, to have licensed and insured vendors. Yes?
What if it's unit owners wanting to work on the property and they get hurt?
Hmm. Well, there's the follow-up question was, what if it's unit owners that want to work on the property? We've dealt with this issue in different ways because a lot of communities, especially when you're dealing with a lot of tough economic times that we find ourselves in, as the community... to maintain the standards, you know, that you had talked about for marketability and just for habitability, choose to try to pitch in and do some work around the property themselves to save a little bit of money. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. I think the association needs to be cautious in how they handle that. And what I suggest is you might want to talk to your insurance agent to talk about at least a minimum workers' comp compensation insurance policy, and talk about what you intend to do. Also, I would discuss, even though it won't wholly insulate you, you may talk about having some type of volunteer waiver that the association council can draft up and have the volunteers sign, indicating that whatever the activity may be, you know, that they're responsible for whatever it be. Now, it won't completely insulate you. It's not going to be bulletproof, and don't just a second, sir. It won't completely protect the association from a potential claim.
How did you even know somebody was doing it?
Well, if the association doesn't have knowledge that a volunteer is doing some action, then in most instances they won't be responsible for it. The only instances may be if you're dealing with known dangers or something to that effect, but we can, you know, that's a little out of the topic area, but dealing with the dealing with those vendors, it's, you know, the best practice, of course, is, you know, have them insured, have them licensed. For volunteers, as I said, you know, look to see about a limited workers' comp policy that may help with that. But of course, you know, make sure that your volunteers perhaps are, you know, in good enough shape or able to do the things that they're trying to accomplish. And if it's something that requires a license, if that volunteer doesn't have that license, don't let them do it. If it deals with electrical work, in most municipalities, you have to have a licensed electrician. So don't let the handyman or the volunteer, you know, be changing out light fixtures or light switches and all that. It seems fairly innocuous, but if that person gets electrocuted, that could be a potential liability for the association. And you had a question, sir.
Briefly said, working on top, the association have to have a license contract, but do they have to have working top insurance, or is working top exemption from the state? All right.
Well, there. Depending on how many employees that the association has. I want to say it's four or more if they're just standard employees.
I'm sorry, I meant outside contractors.
Oh, for outside contractors, you're not necessarily required to have workers' compensation as an association. We find that sometimes the contractors that are hired say that they have workers' compensation, and sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't, or it's not as. Mm-hmm. The question was that if you have, say, a small construction company, for example, and they say that they're principals of the corporation, so therefore they're exempt from the workers' comp. Now, legally that may be the case, and they may not be legally required, although a lot of people try to name their gopher the vice president just so they don't have to get workers' compensation insurance for them. But nonetheless, there may be instances where, in fact, they are exempt. In those situations, I would say that's why it's even more doubly important for the association to have at least a minimum workers' compensation insurance to be able to cover that, if there is, in fact, some type of instance. And that's really truly something you could talk to your insurance agent about and kind of explain and discuss the nuances of that. If you already have four or more employees, you probably already have workers' compensation insurance, so it may not be an issue. But for those communities that don't really have employees or they primarily have, you know, independent contractors, perhaps their management company is an independent contractor and they essentially have all of the employees that the association uses, there may be an instance where you still need to have or it's at least recommended to have a minimum policy. The reason why it's good to have a minimum policy is that if it does qualify for a workers' compensation claim, then the association isn't subject to a premises liability claim in addition to the workers' comp, and it goes into a whole other area. But again, that's a little bit more in depth than we probably want to get today on that. I'd definitely talk to your insurance agent about that, and that will make sure that you're hopefully adequately protected. Okay, as far as board liability, we talked about gross negligence. We talked about bad faith. We also talked about criminal misconduct. The example we used was embezzling, stealing association funds. There's other examples, of course, but I'm sure you can think what they may be. Another example that a board member could be personally liable are improper personal benefits. We talked about earlier soliciting or accepting kickbacks. If you solicit or accept kickbacks, there is a possibility that you could be personally liable for that. So bear that in mind as well. Association powers and duties, moving on here in the outline. There's a statutory reference there that's set out, but basically the association's powers and duties are set forth in the Condominium Act. They're also set forth in the Declaration of Condominium, also the Articles of Incorporation, the bylaws, and to a limited extent, for a not-for-profit corporation, it'll be in Chapter 617 of the Florida statutes as well. Typically, the Condominium Act, which we have copies of here, will typically provide for most of the things for the board governance as opposed to Chapter 617. And in fact, there's a provision in Chapter 617 that says that if there's a conflict between the two, Chapters 718 will control.
Can I ask one more question?
Yes, ma'am, of course. The question was, can you ban smoking with a simple rule for the common areas? And that will always come back to, and in fact, one of my colleagues, Kara Thomas, wrote an article called Butt Out that talked about smoking and talked about smoking in the common areas as well as the possibility of banning smoking in the units. So if you get an opportunity, you might look to see if you can get a copy of that article. Just a second, ma'am. But it's always going to come back to, if it's a board-made rule, for example, rules and regulations are subject to a test of reasonableness, as opposed to a use restriction and a declaration. There's case law that says it's not subject to a test of reasonableness. Now, there's other checks, of course, if it's illegal or other things like that, but nonetheless, you won't have to get over that bar if you had to try to prove that. The question will be whether that's reasonable. And I would say that if it's, depending on how broad the rule is, if you make it so broad that you can't smoke anywhere on the common elements, there's a lot more chance that an arbitrator or a judge could find that that's perhaps unreasonable. If you limit it to designated smoking areas, that clearly makes it much more reasonable. For the folks, so odds are that rule will be much more enforceable. If you really truly want to try to ban smoking in your community, again, read the article first. But I think you may be able to get a copy of it actually on our website. I think there may be a link to that. If not, you can call my office and I can look to see if I can find a copy of it, and I could probably email it to you. And it definitely will address this in a lot more depth than of course we have time for. But that would be the step, and of course it's a pretty aggressive step to amend the declaration to ban smoking. I think as time goes on and as perhaps fewer and fewer people smoke or the more in vogue it is to not allow smoking in public places or what have you, you know, I think the climate will change. But at least for now, if you really want to make a rule like that stick, it's better to have it in your declaration. Oh, you had a question, ma'am.
Back to the fiduciary relationship. Is a board member required to keep secret any transactions that go on between board members? In other words, keep it hidden from the residents? Mm. Or can you share that with your residents?
Is there any situation in which a board member can keep secret communications or what have you? All situations between board members, or are you always obligated to share that information? I would say that there are instances in which you don't have to share that. A perfect example would be if you're meeting with your association counsel, an attorney-client privilege meeting, to discuss that. Also, as far as keeping things secret, if you don't have a quorum of the board present discussing association business, it's not required to be an open meeting. It's not required to be available for the union owners. If you do have a quorum of the board that's in a room talking about association business, then the arbitrators found that that's a board meeting, in which case you can't whisper from board member to board member in that context and in front of the owners.
What I mean is the email transmissions that go back and forth about all of the situations that come up that are being handled by the board, are those supposed to be kept completely hidden from the rest of the residents?
The question was dealing that she had asked deals with whether board member emails are necessarily or whether they can be kept secret, and that really touches more on whether that's really part of the official records of the association and as to whether they have to be maintained. There are instances, of course, that there may be board emails that may be considered official records. If it's an email that's from your personal account and you're emailing another board member, typically that won't be part of the official records and is not typically required to be divulged to the owners. There are instances where perhaps if you're using the association's email address or if you've copied the association's email address, that there may be instances in which that email that was received by that association's email address is in fact an official record of the association, so in that instance could arguably be subject to inspection and copying. There are also yes, ma'am.
What about you having a unit owner that's behind on their maintenance fees and you're trying to work this out, and mm-hmm. they get emails go back and forth, between your management company or your other board members trying to figure out how we can help them get back on track. Mm-hmm. Can that be discussed or made open? Can you talk about that at a board meeting by name and unit?
Mm-hmm. The question, which kind of adds on to her question concerning whether these board member emails can be secret if you send emails back and forth to your management company and what have you, and there may be instances in which if you are in fact sending emails to your management company, that those could arguably be subject to inspection and copying. It's not a hard, fast rule for any of those things typically, and there are some cases that address in some instances. If you have emails, of course, to your association counsel, my position, of course, is that the rule will be that it's privileged, and in most instances, if it's especially if it could be damaging to the association, you take the position that it is, in fact, privileged and it is, in fact, secret and not something you have to divulge to the owners. And if someone wants to press it, then, in those instances, we actually will seek court intervention to get what's known as an in-camera review to determine whether that is or is not, in fact, you know, attorney-client privileged information or not. Unfortunately, I can't give you a hard, fast rule, you know, on those situations. The ways to avoid them being, and we had a question here and a question here in just a second, sirs. The best thing is, you know, don't copy the association's email address. If you truly want it to be private, sometimes it may be best to leave the management company out of a certain discussion as well. I also want to stress that just because there may be some emails that perhaps can maintain, you know, be secret, don't be making board decisions outside of the context of a board meeting. You still need to make decisions in board meetings and open board meetings that have been properly noticed. And this is a follow-up to the question you had? Okay.
Well, what about the same thing? You're talking about an owner that's delinquent. Can that come right out in the board meeting with their name and unit number and say CCQ and 8 something?
Well,
behind and all of that kind of stuff.
That touches on a little bit of a different topic. I tell you what, when we get to financials and all of that, then we'll come back to that. And if I haven't addressed it at that point, please ask that question again. We have a question back here, and then we'll come to the gentleman over here, I believe. Yes, sir. I heard unsavory character, but what was the...
What is our power of protection against having those types of people as tenants in the condo association?
Okay. That's really a... The question was, what type of authority does the association have in keeping out unsavory characters? Was that a fair reiteration? Well, that's a pretty broad topic. That could really address a lot of things, such as screening. You know, whether the board has approval to screen tenants and that sort of thing. As far as, you know, keeping people who aren't tenants out of the community, there may be obligations really by the association if there has been, you know, criminal activity on a recurring basis, such as, you know, vandalism to cars or certain things like that. There have been situations where the association has made the decision to put in security cameras, and the division has found that's okay, that's really part of their maintenance responsibilities. And in fact, there's also, you know, case law to support the fact that, you know, if you're have a situation where this is known, and maybe you don't have, you know, bright lights to provide for security and all that, associations can actually be found liable by not providing at least some semblance of a security system or you know, adequate lighting or like that. So those are things that can kind of address some of those issues. But really, truly, you know, dealing with you know, any. The biggest one that I always come up across are sexual predators or you know, pedophiles. And in those situations, and unfortunately, it's usually a situation where you have 30-year-old documents that don't really have a real clear provision concerning the approval process. It just says that the board has the approval ability and its absolute, you know, sole and absolute discretion. And that's unfortunately a pretty subjective standard. That's really, you know, could be potentially subject to a challenge in court for that. Now, how do you address that? Well, one way that we try to address that is we'll amend declarations to specifically provide for good cause reasons to reject somebody. Make them objective standards. Example would be, of course, if somebody is a convicted sex offender. Or has committed some other acts of moral turpitude within, you know, and usually try to give it some period of time. I always base it on the federal evidentiary code, which says that if it's a crime if it's a felony that was committed within the last 10 years, then it can be admissible against the person as evidence of character. And so I use that standard a lot of times for that. There's also exception to that. If they've committed certain acts, heinous acts of moral turpitude, then there's usually no time limit in that sense. But those can be good cause reasons that the association can deny the occupancy or the sale to that particular individual that falls within any of those categories. Now, some of those situations, typically, if a lot of documents will say that the association has the authority to reject somebody, but they have to find an alternate purchaser. Now, there are some. There's a case called Coquina Club, in which I believe the issue was the person had a pet when they were going through the screening process, and the building was a no pet building. And it was before all the emotional support animal stuff and all of that funny business. But it was a situation where the person admitted that they had a dog. And so the association rejected the applicants because they said, well, if we accept you, you're going to be in violation of our of our rules. And the court found that, well, let me further elaborate, that the owner tried to sue the association to compel them to find an alternate purchaser or purchase a unit themselves. And they fought it, and the court held that the association did not have to exercise its right of first refusal and did not have to find an alternate purchaser because the person did not facially qualify for membership. The person had a dog, admitted he had a dog, and therefore would be in violation from the day one. And so therefore the court said that, if somebody doesn't facially qualify for membership, you don't have to approve them. Because otherwise, the situation would be that an owner, if they just want to, try to sell it to anybody, could bring anybody in there, convicted axe murderer, and say, hey, here you go, and that'll force the association's hand to have to exercise its right of first refusal, and the court found that that was not equitable. Just a second, folks. But with the good cause provisions, that's another example, and a lot of them haven't been tested, at least some of the ones that that we propose in our amendments for good cause. But our position is, wouldn't you rather have that authority in your documents that you can at least point to, so that way you can try to deny that person, and if it goes to court all the way and you fight it tooth and nail and then somehow you lose, it's better to have it than not. Don't you think your community would much prefer that you fought to enforce a no sexual predator provision in your governing documents and lose than not to have one at all or not even try and approve them? Of course. Now, we had a question. Yes, sir. If you have a good the question was, if someone has been released from the penal system and has paid their debt to society, whether you can deny them for sale or rent. And that goes back to what I was saying before. If your documents have a good cause provision that allows you to reject for those types of things, and you may have the ability to, are there instances where somebody may have committed those things but otherwise not be... it might be okay to approve? Sure. And it gives the board at least some discretion or to determine whether that conviction that happened 20 years ago for stealing a candy bar is really relevant to them buying a unit today. So, yes, sir.
Don't let them get you off track as to what you want to talk about, because they'll have a tendency of doing that and just keep going questions and answers. So
okay,
if
good
it's
point.
What you want to do, that's fine, but if not, you take control of it.
Okay. Thank you, Roger. Okay, well, just for the sake of time, because we're going to be taking a break here shortly, I'm going to go ahead and keep going through the condominium operations. If we had some folks to raise their hands, if you have some questions, catch me at the break, and we'll address some of that, okay? Yeah. We don't have a lot of time, so I'm sorry. I wish I could stay in all day. Okay, the next issue here, dealing with annual meetings of unit owners, I think you're all probably pretty familiar with that. You know, with the election process, you have to have the two notices and all that. If you have questions, let me know. Maintenance of the common elements, we already touched on quite a bit already. Directors voting at board meetings. Is there any instance in which a board can vote by a secret ballot? Well, I mean, within the context of a board meeting, can a board member vote secretly for anything? No, most of the time. The only thing that you can vote by a secret ballot is the appointment of officers. So bear that in mind. If you're at your organizational meeting, you can vote by secret ballot. But otherwise, if you're going to vote, it's got to be open. It can't be a secret ballot. Also, the statute was amended to provide that it used to be that a board member, you know, could really only abstain if there was a conflict. The statute was amended to allow board members to be able to abstain, and it's also deemed to not count for or against whatever the action is being assented to. I wouldn't recommend using that very often. It's otherwise a board will never get anything done. But if for some reason or another you feel that that you do need to abstain from a particular vote and you don't have a conflict exactly, then you do at least have that option. Commingling of association funds. The statute allows you to essentially commingle the association funds to a limited extent. However, you can't commingle the association's funds with your individual funds. you can't commingle the association's funds with another association even. And the example that comes up, if you have a community that's a multi-condominium, where you have one association that operates several different buildings that have their own declarations of condominium, there can be limited exceptions, but typically you can't commingle each of those condominiums of funds. Holding and noticing of meetings, and I'll come back to unit owner inquiries later. Holding and noticing of meetings, of course, if it's a board meeting, how long does it need to be if it's just a regular board meeting? 48 hours, that's right, 2 days. What if it's a special assessment meeting? 14 days. What about a budget meeting? 14 days as well. Now, a 14-day notice is mailed to the owners and also posted conspicuously for both the special assessment as well as a budget meeting. Something that they added to the statute is the deductible approval. Now, for the association to approve deductibles, you actually have to send a 14-day notice and post it conspicuously on the property. Basically stating that you're going to adopt a specific deductible for your insurance policy. The best way really to handle that, and really it usually comes in the context of a budget meeting anyway, because that's when you're deciding how much your insurance is going to cost you anyway, and of course the deductible goes part and parcel with how much your insurance policy is going to be. So in those situations, just include in your budget meeting notice an item dealing with determination of insurance deductible. Just a second, ma'am. Also wanted to address unit owner inquiries. Now, who can give me the distinction between a unit owner inquiry and a written request for a record inspection? Yeah, that's part of it. The distinction is that for a written records request, they, of course, submit it in writing. But the goal of a written records request is to inspect and potentially copy the records. Whereas if it's a unit owner inquiry, they're really just asking the board a question. You know, how much do we have in reserves for paving, or how much did we spend on lawn maintenance over the last 3 years? Those are questions. They're not asking to see documentation. They may ask for both, of course. But those are two independent things to deal with. And they have different rules. If you have a request for inspection of records, you have 5 working days to make those available for inspection. And if you fail to within 10 working days, then you can actually be found liable, and starting on the 11th working day, you can be liable for statutory damages of $50 per day up to $500. And that could be in addition to any actual damages that they may be able to show, plus their recovery of attorney's fees and costs. So it's a fairly short period of time. Now, if you have a unit owner inquiry, on the other hand, where they're asking the association an affirmative question, that's a little different. You have a little bit more time. If the association is going to answer that, it's going to be 30 days. You have 30 days to respond to that. If the association refers it to their association council, you actually will have 60 days to get an affirmative substantive response back to them. You can also even refer it to the division. For example, if you seek a declaratory statement from the division. With that, it states that you just have to give them an answer within 10 days upon receipt from the division of that answer. So it buys the division a lot of time, I guess, unlimited time to be able to answer that question. But you only have 10 days to turn that over. And there's different penalties involved with that as well. But it's important to recognize that there is a distinction between the two. And you may have a letter that actually has both. Now, of course, if you can answer the questions and within the time frame to do a records inspection, then more power to you. But sometimes you have to step back and make sure that you're not admitting something that will be held against the association at a later time. Any questions on that part?
Well, they want to bring their attorney to look at the records.
That's typically fine. It doesn't change the time frame. The question was, what if they want to bring their attorney with them to review the records? And we could address. I'll just touch upon that here for records maintenance. But the board has the ability to adopt reasonable rules concerning the frequency, time, duration, so on and so forth of a records inspection, and it can be. Arguably, you could potentially make a rule that they can't have their association council present, but dollars to donuts, the division's going to find a violation with that because they're going to say that they weren't allowed to have adequate counsel to review to know what it was that they were looking at in the first place. So in most instances, unless it's going to be otherwise clearly disruptive, I would recommend allowing their counsel to come in and inspect it with them if they're willing to pay them several hundred dollars an hour to come there and look at the financial records, then let them. Yes, ma'am.
The request, does it have to actually be in writing or can it be an email? I want to go look at your minutes.
The question was, does it have to be in writing or is an email sufficient for, I assume, either a written records request or inspection? The statute doesn't clarify the manner in which the writing to request the records has to be delivered, so arguably it could be by email. I think that it's best if you want to accept them by email, designate a specific email address, an association email address for the inspection of those records. And you can, as I said, you can adopt those reasonable rules and regulations. So that way you don't have them sending emails to one board member, then another board member, and so on and so forth. Have it focused on one. If it's a written inquiry, it has to be by certified mail, or at least the statute says it has to be by certified mail. The division has been, I think, a little bit loosey-goosey with some of that, but nonetheless, the statute in writing says that it's supposed to be by certified mail. Let's see here. Okay. Any questions just dealing with what we touched upon in the condominium operations context? One question here. The question was, who is it that has authority to respond on behalf of the association, whether one individual board member has that authority or if it needs to be something that's approved by the board? Action taken by the association is taken by a majority of the board in most instances. The board can delegate certain responsibilities, of course, to a director or an officer. So there can be instances where the secretary or the president may respond, you know, to those types of requests. Of course, if it's something that's, you know, could potentially lead to some serious litigation or cause, you know, some damages or culpability to the association, it'd be best for the board to be all on board, pardon the pun, on what may be released. And in those instances, sometimes you may want to have your association counsel, you know, vet and evaluate what it is that's going to be returned over. It's not clearly spelled out in that way, no. It just says the association must respond. Yes, ma'am.
Can the board approve it with under property management laws?
That's a pretty specific question. Let's address that during a break, I think. Yeah. Okay. For sake of time, I'm going to go ahead and start the next section here, which I'm going to address insurance. Oh, I'm sorry. We got a couple other questions here, and then we'll move on to the next topic. Yes, ma'am. Sure. The question was about: are there some things that you would redact from the from a records inspection? And this actually touches on. I was thinking that we address it in another section, but this will be a fine section to address it. The statute requires certain things to be kept in your official records under section 718.111, subparagraph 12. And it's basically a, you know, a grocery list of items that have to be kept. You know, for example, copies of the governing documents, plans, warranties, permits, minutes of all association, board, and union owner meetings, which must be kept for at least 7 days. I'm sorry, 7 days, 7 years. Pardon me. You wish you could keep them for only 7 days. A current roster of all the union owners, their mailing addresses, and union identifications, voting certificates, if you have that requirement, so on and so forth. Current insurance policies, management agreements, and all of that. And it's all laid there in the statute. I won't, for the sake of time, I won't go through an exhaustive list. However, there are some things that are considered part of the official records that are not accessible to the owners. We already touched on one example of that, in fact, was you know, attorney-client privileged opinions. Also, work product of the attorney if it's in the process of litigation or imminent litigation. But those work product things have to be made available after the litigation has concluded. However, the statute was amended in July of 2010 to address a couple of additional changes that I would like to touch upon, and I'm glad that somebody raised it before we moved on. Particularly of interest and note are the additions of social security numbers, driver's license numbers, credit card numbers, email addresses, telephone numbers, emergency contact information, any addresses of a unit owner other than as provided to fulfill the association's notice requirements, and other personal identifying information of any person, excluding the person's name, unit designation, mailing address, and property address. And that's just clearly a you know, consumer protection measure. That's just to protect the privacy of the unit owners. The questions that we get with that are, well, our community has a directory, or we have an online directory where, you know, the owners have their email addresses, they have their address, you know, up in New York when they're up there after the season's over, and they have their telephone number on there. Does that mean that we have to throw out all of these directories and that we can no longer, you know, publish a directory? And the position that we've taken, in fact, we're working on a glitch bill to kind of address it as well. But the position we've taken, as well as I've heard the division representative John Pete indicate in a cluster housing seminar I attended last year, say that, you know, the intention of the law was to make that the rule, but if people want to waive those rights, then they can certainly waive them. Now, how do they waive them, of course? What we're proposing is that and before you prepare your next directory, we recommend getting a written waiver from all of the owners for any of that additional information that may otherwise have to be kept out of the official records. That would be, you know, those telephone numbers, those email addresses, you know, or what have you. Also, and typically the written waiver will say that this waiver is good for until it's revoked. However, the changes won't be incorporated until the next written directory is published. So that way, you don't have to every week be throwing out huge bundles of your directories because somebody decides to change their mind whether they want to have their email address on there or not. Now, if you post that information on your, say you have a website where you also have that information, it's much easier for you to be able to have your webmaster get in there and make the corrections, make those changes on a much more timely manner. So usually we'll say, however long you think is appropriate. Give yourselves 2 weeks, give yourself a week, a couple days in instances, whatever you're comfortable with, to remove that information. The other alternative that some communities have considered is to essentially take it out of the association's hands, have a group of unit owners that have no direct affiliation with the association, don't receive any money from the association, receive any direction from the association board, and have them put the directory together. Why? Because they're not bound by these official records guidelines that the association is. This is just what the association is or is not allowed to provide as a records inspection. That doesn't mean that if an owner happens to have that information that they can't, circulate that as well. So those are some options there. Question concerning this issue?
New because the last meeting that I heard about that, they said there was no way you couldn't have people sign themselves out of, in other words, people could not sign the paper and say it's okay to put my name out to whoever asked for it. That's what we were told, but there was no exception.
The statement was that she had heard that there was absolutely no way that you could waive it. We don't take that position. As I said, our position, as well as the John Pete from the division, has taken that an owner can in fact waive that. And in fact, our glitch bill that we're working on will clarify the fact that owners can in fact waive those rights, waive that information to that. I'm not sure who may have said that it wasn't.
It was somebody from, is this the division that is in charge of that? It was somebody from there.
Well, sometimes the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. there may have been an informal opinion, but at least as far as the position that we've heard in our cluster housing seminars, as well as the position that the firm has taken, is that it's much like the situation. In fact, this is the example that the division chief used, was it's similar to the two envelope system in the election process. If an owner decides that they want to waive their anonymity in the inner envelope and not use an inner envelope and just shove it in the outer envelope, that's been found to be acceptable because they just waived that their privacy. And he used that to analogize the same situation. But hopefully it won't be ambiguous after this legislative session ends, and we'll get some clarification that, in fact, we were right after all. The question was, can they bar the association from giving out their name and phone number? And the answer is name, no. The official records, and in fact this provision even says that the person's name, unit designation, mailing address where notices are received, and the property address is available for inspection and copying by the owners. Telephone number? Telephone number, yes. If an owner, and bear in mind again, the rule is that you're not supposed to make that available. However, if you do go through this additional step of getting these written waivers, we feel that will be defensible. All right. Yes, Harry. I'd like to note that Harry just put me on the spot. He asked me what I think of John Pete as a speaker, and I would like to say, speaking into the microphone, I think John Pete is an excellent speaker. And with that, I tell you what, it's 10:30. Let's take one more question. We'll take a 5-minute break. We'll make it short so that way we can get back and hit some of this material. Yes, ma'am.
We use our email. So
but we do use that as a formal communication between the board and our membership.
The question was that, and I'm going to elaborate on it and correct me if my assumption of facts is incorrect, but she said that their association uses electronic transmission, in this instance, email, as their primary form of communication to the owners for notices and so on and so forth, and whether there was any problem with that. And I'm going to elaborate the question and say whether those email addresses would, in fact, be available for inspection by the owners. And the answer to that, and again, it goes back to the general rule will be that email addresses typically are not. However, there's a provision in the official records that says that if an owner grants permission to receive the official notices of the association via email, that becomes their official means by which they receive notice. And if that's the official means by which they receive notice, then that will be an exception to that general rule that email addresses are generally excluded from that. You have to be careful with that because there is a specific provision that says that if they revoke that right to receive notice by the email, you're supposed to remove that from the official records and so on and so forth. But nonetheless, if it is, and that would fall under the category where it says in the statute where they receive official notice from the association, and it would fall under that category. All right. Well, we're going to take just a 5-minute break here. I've got 10:30. Well, I've got 10:31. Let's come back at 10:35, and we'll keep going. Thank you.